because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Leads the country in offensive rebounding.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver, the founder, CEO, and creative mind behind BasketballImmersion.com. This is the podcast where you will hear real basketball coaching conversations. Whether you are a new or experienced coach at any level of basketball, these coaching conversations will give you practical ideas to stimulate your coaching and make what you do even better. Without any more delay, let's share the game. On the Basketball Podcast today, Jonathan Smith, head coach at Morristown West High School in Morristown, Tennessee. The youngest head coach in Tennessee and just recently obviously finished playing collegiate basketball at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. And Jonathan's here today because he reached out to me to ask a bunch of questions about how so many of the ideas that I share relate most specifically to high school coaches. And Jonathan, I really appreciate you reaching out and connecting, and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate the opportunity to come on and just talk basketball.
Well, and that is the whole point of this. And even more so, I never want anything that I do to be framed as just for collegiate level or just for the pro level or whatever it may be. And like many coaches, I've coached at all levels of basketball from youth on up, and I still coach a lot of youth level basketball when I do basketball camps. So I want to make sure that whatever context I share, it helps all coaches. So maybe I'll start with you, Jonathan. Why did you reach out?
I think what I've found in my research and my just listening to your podcast, it's just so much valuable information for me as a new head coach. And as I try to develop what we're going to do offensively and defensively as the year is coming close to the start, I just found your podcast to be very valuable in terms of information and riveting information that I can take and put it on the level of sports we have here in high school. And I think one of my mentors always told me that you can always find tidbits and information in every kind of clinic and podcast kind of venue that you find. So I just found valuable information in what you're doing. So I appreciate the quality of work you're doing.
Thank you. And thing is, I think the coaches that have been on here shared really good stuff, but I think all cases we've tried to relate it to all levels as well as much as possible. And the challenge for all coaches, I think Don Meyer used to say, is that get all the good ideas you can, but you can't use them.
Exactly. Exactly.
So how are we going to figure that out?
Right.
Let's start with the high school level, talking a little bit about practice. Give me an idea of what's your practice schedule during a week.
So we are not allowed to start practice in the state of Tennessee until the week of November 1st. And so the rule that we have in our state is we can have individual workouts with three players, and it has to be the same three players every day. And so the crazy thing about our rule is we're not allowed to start practice until that day. And we start our first live games around November 12th. And so we are given a short window of time that we have to execute all this different information that we want to put into our practice. And so the one big thing that I have tried to implement as I start this year, and we did this, you know, starting in the summer, is we only get three kids a day once school starts. So how do I maximize that time in order to proficiently improve and develop the kids I need to develop? And I know that from the podcast that you have published and just from talking to you, you have some valuable information that maybe can help us as high school coaches to implement those things in the short amount of time that we have.
Well, let's talk about the individual workouts then, which, number one, I like that it's not an individual workout. I like that at least it's a group, because sure, I'm not a big believer in one-on-one player workouts or with a coach, okay, as much as group workouts, because again, from knowing my stuff a little bit, you know that I value the context. Like, I value that we give, yes, the task a representation that happens in the game. So having multiple players there allows you to go offense versus defense. So let me give you an idea of what a workout would be. So a workout, sure, for us would be some type of mixed drill, and I'll circle back and explain that. Some type of drills that incorporate our basketball decision training. So our decision training cues, hands up, hands down, or something like that. And then we would progress pretty quickly within that to some type of one-on-one or some type of advantage, disadvantage, which would be in a group of three, it would be two-on-one. It would be two-on-one, sure, because that's what we can do. And essentially, beyond isolated shooting training, we would try and mix as many of the components together as possible. And that's why I call it a mix drill. Let's say I say, Jonathan, we're going to start. Everyone's got a ball, go to a rim. We're going to go three times between our legs, shoot the ball. In that very simple concept, every player one is learning by doing because they're physically practicing. They're not waiting in line. Sure. And they're working on skills that happen in the game. Dribbling, footwork, which we call fight for your feet when your feet get to the ground in that action reaction before you shoot. They're working on picking up the ball and they're working on shooting. And we mix different things together where it's sometimes it's some 1 foot shooting. Sometimes it could be, again, three times between your legs, push out your dribble into attack the basket, back pivot. And we're mixing a whole bunch of things together so that we don't just train dribbling in isolation or we don't just train shooting in isolation because, well, a lot of reasons. One, that's how the game's played. But two, you don't have time. You don't have
time exactly
for that. If you've got them for an hour, you don't have the same three players every day. That's even more important. The other value of that, they can do this on their own. So I'm a big believer in this is that really the best players are the ones that get better on their own. It can't all be coach-led. It's got to be player-led. So you giving them these types of mixed drills, and I would imagine I have over 200 of them now, but you could invent so many of them on your own, like they're not complicated. And it's just something that a player can go in the gym and get reps on their own of these different things that are really trying to design to get them comfortable with the ball. So that type of concept. Does that make sense? That's the first part of a workout?
Yes, that's great information to apply. I know for me and possibly for you growing up in kind of the fundamental quote unquote world that we used to start every workout with two ball dribbling or one ball dribbling, you know, figure eight dribbling, things like that. And I know that just seeing the product of that kind of drill, number one, it bores kids, in my opinion, to death. And number two, you know, you do those things anyway in the course of a game. And so to have that mixed drill kind of concept, I think you're dead on with the fact about we only have an hour. You know, a high school kid's attention span is not going to be 2 hours long. And so how do we maximize their thought process and their stimulants into a drill that's effective in many different dimensions? And so I appreciate the idea of a mixed drill. That's very applicable to our level for sure.
And we won't get into some of the science behind it, but contextual interference, some of these words that people, if you want to look up, but basically, again, you're forcing them on each rep because it's random, it's variable. On each rep, they have to remember what they did rather than this block concept where they do the same thing over and over again. So what it really emphasizes for is it's a big difference between memorizing and learning. And that's where we're trying to go. And we won't get into the science here too much. I just want to focus it in. But you said it. It's being repetitions without being repetitive. Without being repetitive. What you come back to when you talk about that magic circle where we all stand in a circle and we do those dribbling drills. And I'm not saying a player shouldn't do those, but I think those should be player-led, not coach-led. Like if a player wants to do all those drills that they see on YouTube, I'm cool with it. I'm never going to tell them not to do basketball drills or whatever they want to do. Because it gets them to work on a ball, work with a ball on their own.
Sure.
Brilliant. Go. But when I'm working with them, I want them to focus as immediately as possible on the game. So then we add something called BDT, basketball decision training. And again, people can go Google. There's lots of literature if you don't know what it is online.
Right.
But basketball decision training where there's some type of cues now. So we're trying to bridge a gap between on air. That means they're dribbling, shooting, or doing something without a decision or without a defender. To now incorporating the concept of the decision. It's not true decision-making because true decision-making is offense versus defense, which is why we progress to one-on-one as fast as possible. But it gives them the idea that while they're working on their skills, they have to now read some type of decision. So let's give you a simple example. Take one of the ball handling drills. What's a ball handling drill you do, Jonathan, with your players?
Oh, we do double cross, in and out cross, different kind of moves, combo moves, things like that we do.
Okay, so are they starting at center, dribbling in, making a move, and then going to the basket, that type of idea?
Well, most likely with the defender, things like that, yes.
Sure, and let's say it's just on air to start with. So, okay, you've built that concept on air. You could do that in one practice. You don't need to do that every practice. So what I'm saying is after you've built it, and again, it's fine to build it without defense to start with, But once they get the initial concept, it doesn't have to be perfect. The skill doesn't have to be perfect. What we would immediately add is BDT. So as a coach or as a teammate, say you stand on the opposite three-point line and they approach dribble, they approach the place where they're going to make the dribble move. If you put your hands up, they've got to hook pass it to you, relocate, get back, and now you can play BDT with them, or you can just pass it and then they shoot. Right? So you're adding some type of decision where they have to be aware of something that would be happening within a game. And that would be they make a dribble move, defender helps, and now they have to kick to the open player. That can be added literally to any drill, that type of thing. So that would be, again, I wouldn't spend a ton of time on adding BDT. The next part is, as much as possible, now progress that drill into live one-on-one. And again, I think at all levels, the best development for players is one-on-one. You know, in different types of one-on-one where you give context, and the rule I use, but I'd like to hear some of the rules that you give. The rule I give, which is the main one, is they cannot take two dribbles in a direction, not towards the rim. So if they make a dribble move, they beat a defender, they're going to their dominant hand. They can't take two dribbles going to their dominant hand, not towards the basket. And that's what they tend to do, right? They get that third dribble there.
Exactly.
And they finally get around the defender. But the problem is they're essentially dribbling into help. So what are some of the things that you add to one-on-one to make it more game-like?
Well, to piggyback off what you said, I find myself stopping. I don't like to stop one-on-one play, but the time that I do stop one-on-one play is when they're taking a lateral dribble or a useless crossover. And I think for a high school kid, that is super hard to understand. So if you go to a middle school basketball game or you go to a freshman league basketball game, what you will see is that a lot of your early developmental kids dribble with no point or purpose behind it. And kind of to piggyback what you're saying, like my number one rule is you must take a purposeful dribble in a direction that you are trying to go towards the basket. And kind of like you said, yeah. And that's so hard to get a kid to understand. You know, coach, I'm trying to set up my crossover. You can set up your crossover going towards the rim. The lateral dribble is a pointless dribble, in my opinion, unless you're trying to set up, you know, a defender in one way. And so to get a kid to understand that mindset is almost a total concept that they have to learn from scratch. And I tell you, to kind of piggyback off the BDT idea as well, the kids are good about getting past the initial defender. It's reading that second defender that we find to be troublesome for those kids. They're so concerned with beating their man that once they beat their man, they're kind of clueless about what to do with the basketball. You know, do I kick? Do I shoot it? Do I reverse pivot? And what do I do? And so we have kind of taught them how to read that second defender. It's not getting past the initial defender. It's that second defender and help. And so those are all good points, too, that you've touched on.
Well, coach, let's add that then, because that's excellent, is that at the point of attack, that's a decision. At the point of beating the initial check, there's a decision. This is why, again, on air doesn't help them have the context that they need for the game. So there's two ways to play one-on-one, and we play both. One-on-one at point of attack and one-on-one at point of the decision at the rim. And it's real simple. Just have the player now dribble in, because we're going to use the same example. Dribble in, make their dribble move, in and out cross, push their dribble so they just beat some, maybe it's a pylon on air, a chair on air, or a stationary defender. Sure. And now the defender at the rim has one rule for us. They have to take one step, one sprint step away from the direction of the initial attack. So now the defender has to sprint one step. Say the offensive player attacks to the right, the player at the rim takes a sprint step to the left and then recovers, and now it's live one-on-one at the rim. And our point of reference at the rim is the defender has to, we have a charge circle, so the defender has to get outside the charge circle as well.
Right, exactly. But,
you know, and now you're working on that decision-making there. So if you now add BDT to that, so you're the coach, you're on the perimeter, you can put hands up, hands down, and now they've got to read not only the defender at the rim, but they've also got to see the visual cue of the coach having their hands out. That supersedes the decision at the rim. Or it might not, depending on your philosophy or whatnot. But
absolutely,
if you don't have a good decision, then it also gives an opportunity, which I like, an opportunity for a player. Okay, if you're not going to take a good shot, then pass it to the coach, relocate, and play one-on-one off the relocation instead of forcing a shot. Because Because that's the other challenge of one-on-one is a lot of times because there's no choice to pass, it becomes unintentionally a bad shot shooting exercise. And that's right. Why I don't like dribble limits. Dribble limits to me, okay, you can only take two dribbles. Well, what happens in those two dribbles if I don't have a good shot? In one-on-one, I got no choice. I got to fire it. So if you use a dribble limit, then you should have an outlet option. Two dribbles, okay, didn't create something. Pass it to a coach, relocate, play one-on-one off a different spot.
And to be honest with you, until I heard you say that in one of your former podcasts, I was that guy. You know, you get two dribbles is all you. Well, the problem is, like you said, they take two dribbles and then they're like, well, here goes a 30-foot shot with no chance of going in. And so once I heard you talk about that, it made more sense to me. And that's one thing that I have implemented as well. I tell you another thing that I thought about while you were talking about the two-on-one driving kick is one thing that I emphasize in our program is one of the most vulnerable places for a defender is a closeout. And so what we do is we teach our kids to attack every closeout we can and try to get us in that advantage situation. And what I found is just through that, those key words, attack the closeout, we're seeing more progressive drives with, you know, either a baseline drift or one more. And it's making the game easier for kids. I think that's one thing high school coaches can improve on is we have to find a way to simplify the game for our kids. We live in a society of instant gratification with our high school kids. And I know it's probably the same with college kids. You know, they can watch these players on Instagram and they have all these fancy dribble moves and finishes and dunks. And the kids think they have to achieve that level to be a good basketball player. When in reality, a first step to attack a closeout, as simple as that sounds. And it's interesting how much they struggle with a simple concept like that.
Well, no, and very true. And for us as coaches, I mean, the words that we use empower our players. So just, again, you coming up with something that frames it in a certain way for a player, attack the closeout, drive to score, like these different things that give players a power to understand what they're supposed to do. I mean, that's your culture. That's the culture that your players will follow and understand. And no, that's great that you've made that connection as well. So the other part, so when you progress to one-on-one, we want to put our players in as many one-on-one situations that are actually going to happen within your offense.
Sure.
And that's another challenge, I think, for coaches is to understand that, first of all, you choose a drill because it should solve a specific problem for your players.
Right.
Right? Like, why am I going to put them in this one-on-one? Well, because it helps them solve problems that are going to happen in the game. So the attack, the closeout situation. Well, where exactly are your players going to attack closeouts? Don't stereotypically just play off the top. And I remember doing this with a player who was going to college and they came and worked out with me. And I put her in a very specific position where she would be playing within the offense that her college team is going to run. And she said that was the first time she's ever worked specifically out of the place where she plays in the game. And every other person had her playing off the top. Well, she wasn't a point guard, so she never played off the top. So it's something as simple as that, is understanding, well, where's the problem area for your player? Where are they going to be within your offense? And any drill should be solving a problem, but it should be game specific, game-like, and performed at game speed. That's the three G's of drill design.
And one place that I know that we like to attack closeouts is in transition. You know, we emphasize the kick ahead, the reverse pass, the kick ahead in transition. And you'd be surprised how many kids are scared to go make a play in transition one-on-one. And I try to tell them that's the one place that we want to score in one-on-one transition, because I'm going to trust you that you have the skill set to make that play. Another factor that we run into is kids want to pull up a lot in transition, you know, which is fine if you read the defender. But again, attack the closeout, attack his hip, you know, make him make a decision how to guard you. You're full speed and he's going to run at you at his full speed. So let's see what you can do. Where do you attack those closeouts? You know, you just don't roll the ball out one-on-one and attack that closeout, because you're not going to see that at the top of the key much. That's kind of that valuable information piece there too.
Well, it's tricky because, again, like, it's hard to make a realistic one-on-one drill. It's hard to make a realistic drill. And that's the other part of this, is that where you connect some of these ideas is that whatever one-on-one drills you choose to use, in my opinion, they should also be the one-on-one drills that start your 4-on-4 in practice. So you say you play one-on-one off of a closeout, whatever, let's use that example, even though you wouldn't use it, you roll at the ball and you run out and the player picks up the ball. And now it's one-on-one. That's the same drill that we want to start our four-on-four, because we want everything to be one-on-one before it becomes four-on-four. Because if we're putting a player in a situation where they're going to attack a closeout, we want them first to explore their possibility to score without passing.
Sure.
And then they only pass when the defensive help comes into context. So I would challenge a coach too, that if you're doing a one-on-one drill, then think about it in that sense of saying, how does that start our 4-on-4? Because every shell or every offensive breakdown you do essentially comes back to some type of one-on-one.
That's very true.
Coach, let's progress then a little bit here. I know you have some other questions and we can go a lot of directions, but let's give you a context, because now let's connect it to what does one of my practices actually look like? And
that'd be great.
Yeah. So here's the thing. So the beginning of my practices usually tie in what we do in our individual workouts. So the beginning of practice, we'll do either BDT or mixed drills. And that's kind of in our pre-practice phase. Say, you know, and you can give me an idea of what you can do for practice, but say we stereotypically have an hour and a half, 2 hours of practice.
Sure.
Our players, the expectation is they're there 15 minutes early. We're on the court. We're getting into mixed drills or BDT. So they're getting some shooting. They're getting some type of ball handling, some types of ball pickup, footwork, all that stuff done within the beginning of the practice. After that, we move into the body of practice. We aren't a big, we're going to spend 20 minutes warming up. We're going right to the game. And very often we go right to 5-on-5. Because again, most of our practices are 5-on-5 after we get past some initial learning. But let me give you an idea of what we did last night in practice.
Sure.
We went to 4-line closeouts, which again is a very stereotypical drill. And people might be surprised to hear me say that. But we do do drills. We do drills. Now, the reason we would do a drill is because we want to make very specific coaching points that aren't happening in our 5-on-5. So we've been playing 5-on-5. Our players haven't been doing a certain thing well individually within 5-on-5. For example, closeouts. When our players close out, we're trying to force weak hand. Our players are sprinting and turning to force weak hand instead of sprinting square and then shifting. Well, the other thing they're struggling with is that they're getting, especially our young players, are applying body pressure instead of arm length pressure. That we're really big on our players not sprinting with two hands up. They're sprinting and stopping, and then their arm would go out in front of their body, if you can picture that, not to their side. And then that is the length of pressure that they should be at in the closeout. So our players weren't doing that really well in our 5-on-5 or our 4-on-4. So then we go back to a drill to reemphasize it. But as quickly as possible, we get out of that drill. And then we went into what we call 4-on-3. 4-on-3 is three defenders, four offensive players, pretty stereotypical. Pass the ball.
Right.
There has to be one skip pass. And now after that, every player gets one dribble to try and score, or it has to be one dribble kick. So now our defenders are working on the exact situation that we broke down in that drill within a more game-like situation that's live after the first skip. And our offense is working on, again, one dribble reaction, because I find it's a huge problem, especially, again, for young players, that they tend to take that greedy second dribble when they've already drawn help.
Absolutely.
So the question is, now you're in that drill, are you going to stop it? And every time one of our players makes a mistake within what we did in the 4-line closeouts, if they make the mistake in 4-on-3 or they make this mistake in 5-on-5, we're going to stop it and we're going to reconnect that concept for them. Whether I use that through questioning or I use that through giving them feedback, hey, keep the great sprint on your closeout, but add arm length so that you don't get too tight on body pressure. Right? We're going to connect it and reconnect it. And I think the other problem with drills for coaches is the drill doesn't solve a specific problem, but it also doesn't get corrected again when you get back to the game, right? Mm. You do the drill. And then once you get back to the gameplay, you're not correcting again what you tried to build in the drill. Does that make sense of how we would use drill and then get it to the game?
Absolutely. So a couple things I've been thinking about. Number one, honestly, just me being transparent, year one as a head coach, I was doing drills because A, that's what I've been taught all my life, and B, that's what I thought needed to happen in order for us to be good. When in reality, and this could be the case for a lot of high school coaches, you're not doing drills that match your philosophy and the way you play. So therefore, you're just, number one, wasting time, and number two, wasting, you know, an opportunity to develop those players. And I think that's something that I've learned through listening to your podcast is you need to have a specific purpose for if you're going to do a drill. Why are you doing that drill? You know, and that sounds kind of foolish to say, but that's just the truth behind that. You know, I've seen that on a lot of levels of basketball too. Number two, the idea of immediately going into a gameplay situation at the start of practice, I think is a brilliant idea that a lot of young coaches might not be used to seeing. You know, we always lead up to that essential pinnacle of the 5-on-5 towards the middle or end of practice. It's how I always used, you know, to play basketball. You know, we would warm up, we would practice shooting, we would do, you know, defensive shell drill. And it wasn't until the last 20, 25 minutes of practice that we would actually get into competitive situations. And I think that's essential, especially kids these days, is they want to have competitiveness from the start of practice. And so, you know, you spend that first 15, 20 minutes focusing on that four-man closeout, and then you immediately go into, you know, that competitiveness drill, and it changes the complete outcome of practice. And I think the last point that I like what you said is, you know, and when the player messes up, he makes a mistake. The one thing that I like to do that you said is question the player. You know, what did you do there? And it offers that chance for that player to reflect on things he could have done better or one thing that he could have improved on. And it's not a power struggle. Hey, I'm the coach. I'm yelling at you to say, you messed up here. Ask the player, what did he do wrong? What did you see here? And that kind of interaction between a player and coach can develop that trust, that relationship that we focus on to enable that player to do that thing better next time.
No, that's great, coach. I mean, those are great connections. To really, again, for you, self-reflection, for you stimulating your coaching and thinking. And again, nothing that I say should ever be taken as that's the law. Really, again, everything comes back to your comfort. Everything comes back to your realities and what you know. But I just want coaches to constantly think, and I'm not anti-drill. I'm not as anti-drill as people think I am.
Right,
like,
right, right.
I'm okay with drills. I just want them to be very specific to solving the problem and very specific to the game. And then making sure that you don't spend too much time in that drill because it takes away from actual game reps and game learning. And also, I think player enjoyment, which you've said a few times. So when I get into, say, a next thing from that 5-on-3, say, this is yesterday's practice. So yesterday's practice after 4-on-3, we went to 5-on-5. And when we went to 5-on-5, it's 5-on-5. It's what we call closeout rebounding. So say there's four players on the perimeter, one player at the rim, defense basically matches up within the key. On a pass from below the basket out, it's a live closeout and a live shot. The player has to shoot, and then it becomes a closeout, contest, rebound, and run, or offensive rebounding reaction. And then from there, we play two trips of the floor. So we'd go to the other end and back. We'd actually call that three trips because the first trip is live.
Okay.
That closeout. So within that, though, we're saying, okay, if we get the ball on offense, on a rebound and run situation, then we're in our transition offense. If something happens within the flow where I have to stop it to correct, then either we continue the possession right from where it was, or we'll say, okay, it's dead ball now. We run a play at a dead ball situation or whatever it is. But we're playing those three trips and we're making sure within those three trips, we're going to stop it and coach. Because I want coaches to all know in this game's approach to coaching, coaching points are still being made. The discipline and teaching are still there, even though the format is different. So there's focus, there's feedback, there's challenge. Because you said competition. Yeah, there's competition, but we've got to make sure, especially early in the year, that we're going to sacrifice a little bit of competition. And our players still keep score, by the way, even though I don't emphasize score. But within that, we're saying we're going to stop it and make sure that we teach. And we're going to connect and say, in that 5-on-5 closeout, because we've already given closeout rebounding drill, because we've already given that example. If one of our players is closing out with their hands in the air as they run, or if they're closing out and they're turning their body and opening up a path to the basket instead of closing out square and shifting, then I'm going to stop it. And we're going to correct it immediately in that situation. And as I said, we'll correct it with a question. We'll correct it with a quick feedback, and then we'll continue. Because again, this is learning time. When we play 5-on-5, it's not just roll at the ball and scrimmage, it's just learning time. And that's the agreement I have to have with my players is that, listen, yeah, we're going to play in practice, but I'm also going to stop and coach in practice while we play. And that's part of it. So we would go into something like that. And then we basically, again, I want to give you a chance here, but just to finish up. So our practice would have 5-on-5 chase drill after that, which is one player goes in for a layup with all 9 other players chasing them. And then the team that shoots is on defense. And then we go and do 2 trips from there. And that would be us working on our pressure offense versus our pressure defense. And then we go into 5-on-5 versus spread ball screen. So we'd go 3 trips, 1 trip from half court, starts with a spread ball screen. So we're working on a very specific context. We know we're going to have to defend spread ball screen. We know, even though we don't run a lot of spread ball screen yet, that's always a part of offense. And then from there, at the end of practice, we would actually go into our offensive breakdown, which we would not do 4-on-0. We would do 4-on-4 offensive breakdown. We would walk through it, which is a mental rehearsal. Just like, say, if you think about a game day shoot around, it'd be a 5-on-5 walkthrough. But we would do a 4-on-4 walkthrough for both teams where we talk about where the offense would be. We talked about where the defense would be. And then we would follow that by 4-on-4 live. So that would be our offensive breakdown stuff at the end of a practice. So that would give you an idea of how a practice would be structured. What are your thoughts and what are your questions or whatever your ideas?
Sure. So I think the first piece that is really important that we can take away is the idea of connection. You know, you start with a drill, and then as soon as the ball goes live, they lose complete concept of something that you had worked on 10 minutes ago. You know, and so as you stop the drill, it's connecting point A to point B. We did this for the purpose of, so when this happens in a real game, you know, you have that skill set to execute it. And I think that's one of the gray areas high school kids struggle with, is the point of how do I apply this, what I just learned, to a live situation. And so the connection is a key part to our practices every day as well. The other point that I really like is the 4-on-4, you know, offensive breakdown with a defender. I can't tell you how many times that I've been through a 5-on-0, you know, walkthrough where you're conceptualizing, I'm supposed to be here on this set, I'm supposed to be here on this play. You know, something that you don't think about is, well, what about the defender? How's the defender going to guard this action? And so once you kind of see and can visualize where the defender is going to be on this certain action that we're kind of implementing or starting, it can only help the success of the player in that situation. And that's something that I can take away as well to my practices. You know, when you want to put in that breakdown or you want to put in the action, have a defender there. And so you can already visualize where you're supposed to be once the ball comes to you or what are you supposed to do when the ball goes away from you. 2 good points that I can take away for sure.
Well, Coach, and let me give you some more context to the 5-on-0 thing, because again, yeah. I feel like this is some people have a war on drills. I don't have a war on drills. I do think that we waste so much time on-air drills, though. Where again, like I've done it at my level. I've done it with younger kids, so people know that when I teach a new play, we teach it 5-on-5. Now, we walk through it. But I don't walk through it 5-on-0 as traditionally is done. Because again, it's exactly what you're saying. For positive transfer to happen to the game, in my opinion, positioning has to be understood, not just of offense, but of defense as well. Timing, which is huge. When you do 5-on-0,
yes,
the timing is completely different. Like the spatial and temporal elements that exist when there's a defensive situation, completely different. Understanding the concepts. And then obviously the perceptual qualities and strategies that would be key to optimizing it to positive transfer aren't there if you don't have the defense on. And I think it's the same, like to do a defensive drill with no offense. And no, the offense doesn't have to be live, just like the defense doesn't have to be live. But the defense or the offense has to be there to give context, like the positioning and the timing and the perceptual qualities. That all leads to positive transfer, because without them, essentially, they have to relearn it within the context of having a defender there. So why not just start with it there? And it saves you time as a coach. But I think it does help your players get context right away. But again, coach, it is messier. It is messier. That's the challenge for you as a coach, to understand that your players are getting value from it, even though it doesn't look perfect.
Sure. And I know, as a lot of coaches and for myself, you know, one thing we emphasize is execute, you know, execute offensively. You know, what are we running as our set? How do we execute this thing? And so, for example, you know, we'll run a set that has a back screen. So you'll teach a player how to set a back screen in a 5-on-0 situation. And so then you put defense out there and you run it through the first time, and the kid totally whiffs on the back screen because he doesn't know where the defender is supposed to be. And so you stop play and you lose your mind. And the kid is like, well, you told me how to do it this way, you know, and you never thought, hey, the defender's not going to actually be where you think he's going to be. And so now you kind of have that transfer of learning, you know, not only do I have to set up a whole new drill with defense now, I can implement that from the start. And it helps time management in practice as well.
So I'll give you an example, because that's great. That's such a great connection that you just made, because it's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. It's different back screening a player than it is air. There's no question, because you don't know what the defender is going to do. And a back screen isn't just a back screen, right? A back screen might turn into a flare, right? And that back
screen
might turn into a slip, depending on what the defender does. So as quickly as possible that you get to that context. But the other part of the back screen, which I think is so important, is to read the skip option. Because if there's a player on a weak side spacing the floor, what is their defender doing? Like, understanding what the help is doing is so important to running good offense. So understanding that when you have the ball, someone's setting a back screen for a teammate, and then reading, hey, what's the weak side defender doing? The weak side defender is helping on the back screen. Then that weak side offensive player should be lifting so we can skip. And as soon as you have that context of the defense, even if it's not live, at least they're thinking about those other variables that exist beyond just the focus on the back screen. Because again, your players know where the back screen's happening. They don't need to have perception of the back screen happening. They need to have perception of what the defenders covering the back screen are doing. And this is one of the hardest connections, but you got to emphasize this, in my opinion, that your players don't need to look at their teammates. They need to look at the defense. And by having the defense on there, you can start to get them focused on that. Because another problem with 5-on-0 is that you're only looking at your teammates. Well, that's the last thing I want a passer to ever look at is my teammates.
Exactly.
They know the play. They know where the teammates are supposed to be. What they don't know is where the defense is supposed to be.
And I think the minute that you can teach a kid to do that and he starts to do it without thinking about, you know, what am I supposed to be doing here, is the time that you can let those players have that freedom in your offense that you've been looking for the whole time.
No question. There's not a wrong decision if it's made for advantage reasons, right? If an advantage is created, even though, say, a player breaks off a play or a player does something that, oh, that wasn't the play, but if they did it and created an advantage, then do your players know how to take advantage of that situation? That's really ultimately what all good basketball teams do. Because again, I say it on defense, that it's like one of our players makes a decision. It may be the wrong decision, but they made the first decision. Everyone else has to figure it out and have their back to make sure that we make that decision. Ultimately, even if it's the wrong decision, we can still make it the right decision by doing the right things behind that player. And that's the same for offense as well. So, and that's freedom. And that's part of all this that comes together. So, coach, there's so many things and so many ways we can go to continue this. And I do want to continue some of this conversation. I know you have some other questions to get to, but of those other questions, are there some of them that we can get to within the context of what we're doing right now?
Sure. In terms of high school kids are so finicky in the way they learn and adapt to kind of what they see, you know, in terms of film watching, how much film do you watch with your team to show them those keys or those things that you look for? You know, maybe in transition or maybe in the half court offense, you know, you teach a kid to read, you know, the defender, How do you do that in more fine-tuned situations? You know, is it something just with repetition? Do you watch it on film? How do you get kids to really develop that idea of trusting the teammates?
Well, again, let's assume now, and again, on a lot of these situations, we're assuming that you have the perfect situation. Let's say that you have time to do film and you have film. Because that's the first part for many high school coaches is like, okay, let's assume you have the time to do film. And let's just assume that there's productive film. So you film practice, let's say. So the number one thing is that I kind of equate this to how I would teach skills too. That early in the learning process, we would have the team together because I need to make the point to the majority. So I would stop a drill in a practice or a 5-on-5 in a practice if the majority of the team is making the mistake, right? If more than 3-4 players are making the same mistake, then I'm going to stop it and we'll correct everyone. That's how I consider film at the beginning of the year. Everyone needs to see it because everyone's probably making the mistake or they need to, as you said, understand what their teammates are trying to do. But as we move forward within the year, we stop it less for the whole, and we more specifically focus in on the individuals. So if 2 players are making a mistake or 1 player is making a mistake, we'll correct that player, we'll give feedback to that player, rather than stop the whole team. And that's why we stop practice less as the year goes on. It's more because more players are not making a mistake. More players are doing it right, and it's only certain players that we have to correct. Same with film. As we get through the season, we want to make it more individual, more focused on that individual. And that's why if I think about this generation and how they learn, I always want to send as much video to players as possible in as short a clip as possible. Rather than give them, you know, I never want to have an hour video session because I don't like those. Mm-hmm. But I want to give them maybe 1 or 2 clips. Maybe it's 1 clip each day. Maybe it's 3 clips a week. Whatever it is, but those 3 clips, I want them to be really important to that player and really important to our team to help our team get better. But if I show that player 15 clips, I don't think they get as much value from those 15 clips as they would have out of those, say, 1 clip a day where they can really focus in on that one concept. And then when they come back to practice, the most important part of any video is that I'm going to continue to correct them. Or most importantly, I'm going to notice progress and I'm going to connect the value of video back to into practice and say, listen, hey, you did a much better job on that closeout getting square, just like the video example I sent you. So now they connect that, hey, the video is valuable to me getting better because coach noticed that it helped me in practice. And it's not this thing that's disconnected from practice or from the game. It's connected. And that connection, I believe, improves learning.
Absolutely. And that's kind of what I said earlier is the kids are smart enough to know if you're going to keep affirming them and what they're doing. And that's so important. The program that I've taken over has had 4 coaches in 4 years. And so, you know, the previous coach, 2 coaches did a wonderful job with the kids. But, you know, it's trusting that the coach is going to keep affirming me for things I'm doing positively. You know, it's the way that you relate to the players. So if you spend time, you know, on a 1-on-1 film session, just showing 1 clip, that can totally change their perspective on what you're telling them to do. You know, coach cares about me to show this 1 clip. And now he's reaffirming, you know, something that I've tried to work on in practice. And the whole idea is that building of trust too. And I think that can go a long way as well, not only on the basketball court, but in the culture of your locker room. You know, coach reaffirms, he trusts me, I trust him. And so now any kind of pointers you put on the basketball court is invaluable to them to connect back to what you're trying to do.
Well, and again, I mean, do they feel that their time is valued? And do they feel that you are genuinely trying to help them to get better? And mm-hmm. that's part of the value. That's beyond just learning. That's part of the value of video, is that they sense that they learn very quickly that you value them getting better because you're individualizing it as much, you know, and they don't know how much video you're sending to other people anyways, but they definitely know for them that you're trying to do something to help them get better because you care. And I love that aspect. And I think for this generation, And really, for technology that exists nowadays, that's not that hard to do. It is time consuming, but it's not that hard to do. So however you figure out to do it, we do it with a Facebook group. We have a private Facebook group where I can post clips every day, and Facebook in a group setting allows you to schedule it too. So I don't have to send out, if I do a bunch of video in one day, I can trickle it out rather than send it all out together. If I do like 10 different clips, I can send them out 10 different days. And that might be more,
that's a great idea.
That might be more for our group to all see it, but also within Facebook, I can send an individual message to players with a video because it allows you to upload, and obviously it stores the video. So I don't have to worry about video storage and all this other stuff too. So it goes
right
to the player. And then you have a record of it. So it's a really simple, and I know there's other tools. There's some really good tools out there for that as well. But for me, I mean, Facebook's free, and for the most part, it's easy to do. Now, I think, again, high school students, I don't know how many of them are on Facebook anymore. So maybe there's an alternative that works. But for our players, they have to have, whether they're actually on Facebook or not, they have to have a Facebook account. So that's how we do it.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Coach, this has been wonderful. And, you know, maybe after you go through your season, at some point we can circle back and have further discussions on some of the things that we talked about and give some more context to how these ideas work at all levels of basketball. And I really appreciate you reaching out. And I don't know if you have any final thoughts on things.
Thanks, Chris. I really appreciate just the opportunity to ask some questions I have and to provide a little insight on what I see too. I think as coaches, we have such an opportunity to not only increase relationships with, you know, the basketball kind of success in mind, but only to give these kids the opportunity to use basketball as a vehicle to get them where they want to go in life. And, you know, I spend a lot of my time watching film on college teams or NBA teams to try to pick up, you know, offensive tendencies that I like. But I think one thing that is, you know, really, really important is that basketball is a live game that presents so many different situations that you can teach how kids, you know, attack in those situations, advantages, disadvantages, play with constraints, you know, how can you get those kids to really buy into your system? And so, you know, as a high school coach, I can't say thanks enough to you and to what you've done to get so many different level of coaches to come in to talk about, you know, their philosophies on the game. That only increases our ability to relate what we do on an everyday basis to, you know, what's going on higher levels of basketball. And I think that kind of creates that connection that we've talked about this whole kind of podcast that we've done today. So I appreciate the time.
Well, awesome. And thank you for those words. And again, we'll keep sharing the game, and I know you as well. So awesome.
Yes, sir.
All right. Thanks, Coach.
Thank you.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.